Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
And welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr.
Hey, hi, hi.
And we're going to go over the myths of a GLP-1 treatment. Again, we don't make money from Big Pharma.
Or Incretins. Twinkertins.
Twinkertins.
GIP.
Triple G's. Whatever.
We'll see what comes down the pipeline.
We'll see what comes down. But we wanted to go over some of the myths because we just, you know, we see other, you know, influencers posting just absolute nonsense about this. Sometimes they're not physicians, but sometimes they are physicians, which is also, it was even more embarrassing, I think.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of physicians who aren't truly specialists in the area, but have a lot of following, which,
yeah,
influencer. Yeah, influencer
doctors,
yeah,
who pretend to be experts. So they're not. They don't have clearly clinical experience, and they don't have, they clearly aren't reading the literature. So let's go over some of the top ones. I'd say, first of all, I think the top one is these are a short-term quick fix drug.
Boy.
This is something that, like, a lot of the, you know, just regular influencer people that are talking about weight loss talk about, like, hey, don't start this because,
yeah, the fitness influencers, like, what's her face from Biggest Loser? She's probably one of them that says it. Jillian Michaels?
Yeah.
Doesn't she say this kind of thing? Like, start it.
Yeah. But I'm thinking about even like the micro influencers that aren't huge celebrities. I'd say like just you see them. I get tagged in those pretty much daily about someone's like, these aren't, you know, if you start them and you see them, the headlines also like New York Times and some of these other media, they're like, well, if you take these, and you stop them, you're going to regain your weight. It's like, okay. So first of all, is obesity a chronic disease or not?
Well, we had a podcast on that once at the beginning of our podcast year last year.
Yeah.
And it is a chronic, progressive, relapsing disease, and our biology works against us. We talked about it in the genetic episode a few weeks ago. You know, everyone has a different foundation of genetics. We live in an obesogenic environment. Yes, we need to work on that stuff. Some people absolutely can fix some of the issues in their lifestyle, behavioral stuff, dietary things, lose weight and be able to maintain that. We know there are ways to help with maintaining weight loss. But, right, the biology is working against people. And yeah, and all these studies, every time there's one where they suddenly, you know, randomize people to continue the therapy or go to placebo, the placebo group starts to regain the weight. Now, they're not necessarily doing all the extra little things that we would try to be doing from an interventional standpoint. And, you know, we could debate all day long about other methods and medicinal ways to help with weight maintenance. But, right, we're not, once you stop the medicine, you're not treating that part of the biology that's working against people. So then it drives weight regain.
Yeah. So most people will start to regain the weight. Not everybody. There's small subsets of people that might be able to maintain pretty well. So the gist is these aren't meant to be short-term medicines. They are meant to be chronically taken. This doesn't mean you have to take it for the rest of your life, but most will likely have to take it. I think it's the people that have the genetics and the disease of obesity, likely the people that have struggled most of their life, they're likely going to have to be on it indefinitely.
Yeah. Or something similar or some version of it, or as we're, you know, more research is going to be done on how to, you know, for cost effectiveness and whatnot down the road. But otherwise, that's why these are studied and approved for long-term use. That's what we tell people, right? You remember we say the same thing, I'm sure. Like, so, you know, it doesn't mean you have to be on it forever, but it is approved for that because of the disease state.
Yep. All right. Next one. Well, I would say these are used for vanity weight loss or not. I mean, this isn't really a myth. This is just something we harp on all the time.
Yeah.
And you see the celebrities using this,
which is unfortunate.
Really unfortunate.
I just got asked for one of the MedPage Today articles, and it had to do with that whole Wegovy and muscle loss again that we already addressed a couple weeks ago in a podcast. But it was discussed, I think, in my interview with the journalist, and and I said, really, these they are expensive and they are still medicines. You know, joking a little bit, if they were really, really cheap, would everybody be on them? Yeah, almost. You know what I mean? But it's still medicine, and there is a cost to them. And so, if you don't have actual obesity, that is a disease process of excess abnormally distributed adipose tissue that causes health problems, then you shouldn't take these for all the variety of reasons that it's costly. Yeah. It's medication. There is a supply issue, obviously, that we know about. And people with more severe disease definitely get the most bang for the buck, very literally and in some figurative matters.
Yeah. So if you're just using this to fit into your bathing suit or some sort of attire for a wedding. I don't even want to say dress because it can be men too.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Not that men can't wear dresses. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Fitting into some sort of attire.
Cosmetic. It's not a cosmetic disease. And, that's actually part of the stigma and bias that's perpetuated for all these years and why our coverage that we just talked about last week has been an issue. A lot of insurances consider obesity a cosmetic disease, and it just isn't.
No,
and that's the problem. We got to better educate the public on that.
Yeah. Okay. So not for short term use. You might be able to get off of it. Not for vanity use. Must have the disease of obesity. What about? Okay, here's a good one. These drugs are used only for diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And we shouldn't be prescribing them for anyone else.
Right. So, that's a frustrating myth that has been perpetuated by the media, because I don't think they've had the right people discuss it. They've had physicians. I think even that last article I just told you about, has been mentioned, and there's confusion. So for example, we talk about semaglutide, the molecule that is the weekly GLP-1 receptor agonist. It was initially approved for type 2 diabetes, just like its predecessors. We have several versions of these types of medications because these medications really do work on several aspects of the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes, which, by the way, is an obesity-driven disease process with a lot of complicated genetics itself. But in addition to just the glycemic benefits, and I think we'll talk about the heart benefits in a little bit, we talk about how it was shown. All these medications have been shown to improve adherence to nutrition, creating an energy deficit, and weight loss, essentially by work mostly up in the hypothalamus to help people with their appetite and satiety. Well, semaglutide happened to have one of the best results for that. So in addition to type 2 diabetes, where it was approved under the brand name of Ozempic, then of course it was approved at a little bit higher dose under the brand name of Wegovy. And I think the whole branding thing, it confuses people too.
That's ridiculous.
If we only said semaglutide, like we were told to do as med students, nobody would really know the difference. It would just have dosing indication differences.
Yeah. So anybody listening, I see this on TikTok, Instagram, wherever, Twitter, I don't care, Facebook. Mm-hmm. It really makes me mad because it's like semaglutide. It's used for obesity and type 2 diabetes. If there were a shortage of not Wegovy, so the issue was the pen manufacturing, if I'm not mistaken.
Originally, and then it caused a whole cascade of problems.
But if there became an issue with the Ozempic pen and Ozempic went out first, and then all of a sudden those with type 2 diabetes had to use Wegovy, and then there was a shortage of that due to the demand, Nobody would have batted an eye if those with obesity couldn't get their Wegovy due to those with type 2 diabetes using the Wegovy more often. But because it's the other way around, the biases are strong. But nobody, the thing is, it's the vanity thing too. The vanity weight loss prescribing is, I think, is the real issue here, and not those with obesity. You truly need the medicine because it's a therapeutic medicine indicated. Okay.
Well, and it goes back to that spectrum of severity of disease. I was saying people with more severe disease of obesity, not by weight or BMI, but by complications. So, type 2 diabetes is a complication of obesity that does need therapy. Type 2 diabetes, especially with atherosclerotic heart disease, has even more reason to be on these medications, whether it's Ozempic or Wegovy. It doesn't matter because it's the same medicine. And, right. and they both actually come at very similar doses. So sometimes we just give them whatever the insurance will cover. But as you go down that severity, metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, those patients are also at very high cardiometabolic risk, risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease. So they also get a lot of benefit for the buck. The lower the risk, the lower the severity of the disease, the less the benefit, all the way down to those who don't need it at all, right?
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out with the SELECT trial that's coming out. We'll see what happens there. But I think
you
it
mean
goes
for the
down.
Cardiovascular benefit.
Yeah, cardiovascular benefit and those that aren't as high
Well, but
risk.
You know what? I think they don't have type 2 diabetes in that trial, but they have very high cardiovascular risk.
Yeah. But
so
just,
you know,
just
so we'll see. I would expect benefit just like we saw
I think so.
in the technically the Ozempic trial in type 2 diabetes and mostly cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, I think that the whole branding thing is ridiculous.
It is,
honestly,
and it'll be interesting to see what happens to Mounjaro tirzepatide when it gets approved for obesity. Are they going to use the same pen? Are they going to use a different name? Is it going to be all the same problems? I wish Novo. You know, I know you don't care about us, and unless you want to give us money, but
you want to give us some money?
I wish you guys would have kept this just the same pen.
I know. The pen's great. The Ozempic pen is way better, by the way.
Yeah. I think from a clinician perspective, although I've had some patients prefer the other one, so I don't know. You know, obviously.
I like the in-between doses.
Yes. Honestly. Right. That would be nice.
Okay. Next one. People say these drugs cause gastroparesis and they're bad for you. I see this from dietitians on the influencers. They cause gastroparesis. Okay. So gastroparesis is a pathological form of your GI tract not working as well, not functioning as well with motility.
Yeah. It's basically delaying your stomach emptying. And it's not an uncommon complication. I maybe see more than you with a lot of the, not only the chronic
autonomic dysfunction.
Type 2 diabetes, but people with type 1 diabetes. Yeah.
Microvascular.
I have some patients that have pretty severe gastroparesis from neuropathy.
So, these drugs do slow down gastric motility, but it's not causing a pathological gastroparesis. It's a physiological change from due to the medicine, but they're not causing gastroparesis. So this is just a little semantics thing. I don't think it's pedantic, though, because gastroparesis implies a pathological condition. These drugs do decrease gastric motility, which is more of an effect from the drug that I would say is more physiologic, because that's what GLP-1 does. Anyway,
and
that was a quick one.
And, you know, I'll say from our perspective, because we do have these people with gastroparesis, we don't withhold these medications from people who have gastroparesis. No. We explain that, you know, hey, just beware that it's going to slow things down anyways. You already have a slow gastro.
Yep.
So we can help nutritionally treat those patients you know, even better, you know what I mean? Like, you know, we have precautions, we have dietary methods to help minimize the issues from gastroparesis and from the delayed gastric emptying of these medicines.
Yeah.
Now, well, one other thing, have you heard of the small bowel obstruction issue? That's come up.
Yeah, so that's a new, brand new thing. This was a journal out in China. And I don't know, I haven't looked at it in depth. I saw a few of the media out. I've never seen an obstruction.
A
pathological obstruction from
neither
these medicines.
Have I. But
not
when
one.
This got brought up, other people did say, I think some of our colleagues did say they've had some patients. So and so actually the reps, you know, they always look to us for like a little bit more in-depth discussion data because they're only allowed to learn certain things. So I looked it up. There was a big, let's see, what was this? It was from a year ago. You know, it was a big real world evidence observational trial looking at GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitors. So for the people out there, the DPP-4 inhibitors are like Januvia. Januvia is kind of the most famous ones.
Enzyme that breaks down endogenous GLP.
Yeah. And so these are essentially wimpy attempts at keeping your own GLP hormone around longer, but they're very weak and wimpy without a lot of benefit, nor with much side effect, by the way. But in this huge, you know, population real world evidence, the number needed to harm after 1 year of use was 1,223 for the GLP-1 receptor agonists, which remember, these actually have a lot more benefit and and actually some of the adverse effects compared to the DPP-4 inhibitors. And the number needed to harm was 603 for the DPP-4 inhibitors. So it was twice as much. So that's...
It doesn't
make that much sense. It's not something I'd worry about for patients.
No, I wouldn't.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. These drugs cause pancreatic cancer.
Okay. So that they just haven't been shown to do that.
It does take a while for cancer to pop up.
Right. We just don't have any evidence of
there's no data to show that that is a case.
You know, there was early concern of acute pancreatitis with these because they do help the pancreas work better, right? And yeah. There were some associations. People were concerned. We certainly don't give it to people with active pancreatitis.
No.
But meta-analyses of all the trials, especially the cardiovascular outcome trials, have not shown increased risk of pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer, which is really good to know. However, I don't know if we should probably mention the gallbladder issues. There's a very small hint, so low numbers, but statistically significant increased risk of gallbladder disease, which of course can include gallstones, which of course can, you know, lead to pancreatitis in itself. Yeah. So there is that.
We have seen that in our very large online clinic at Sequence. I monitor everything, and I've had a couple pancreatitises throughout our program, and out of like tens of thousands, by the way, people. And it turns out that they were due to gallstones. Interesting. Yeah.
And so that statistics from this, from the meta-analysis that was fairly recently published was 1.58% versus 1.19%. So the relative risk was statistically significant, I guess, but those are really small absolute percentages. So, but it's something to think
about.
If
you lose weight quickly, you can form gallstones. It's a change in the bile composition can form the stones. And they're, you know, is there a difference in how the gallbladder functions due to the GLP-1? That's being debated, and they're monitoring. But I personally wouldn't worry about it. Just know that maybe there's a risk there. Okay, Ozempic face.
So yeah, this got brought up the other day too, and it's been talked about a lot. But when people lose weight, especially those who tend to lose it in your face, you know, people always say, "Well, I lose it here first." Well, yeah, everyone's different about where they store their weight. And, it's your face is included. And, I've heard plastic surgeons talk about it. Cause I've said, "Hey, I got some issues here." And they go, "Oh, it's cause you're too lean." Not humble
so
bragging.
My brother had Ozempic face in utero. When we were younger, people used to say, "Man, you look like your face is like a polygon video game," because he had such a chiseled jawline. Mine, I have a little bit fuller of a face. I have some jowls, but slightly nice jawline. He's got his looks like it was literally carved out of a boulder. And so he's had chronic Ozempic. Yeah. But seriously, there's nothing about semaglutide, tirzepatide, any incretin that is catabolic for any tissue in your face. It's literally from weight loss. And you see it probably more in those doing more vanity weight loss because they don't have as much weight to lose. And then all of a sudden, they're going to lose it in their face. So anyway, Ozempic face, it's a nothing. It's so stupid. It's a media buzzword.
Yep.
Okay, what are the other ones? Oh,
another real concern that's come up is the whole thyroid cancer deal.
Oh, yeah. That's a big black box warning.
You know. So, all GLP-1 receptor agonists in early studies were associated with benign and malignant, what we call C-cell tumors. The C-cells are in the thyroid. They're different than the more common, relatively low-risk thyroid cancers that I see a lot of. And they are the ones that are associated with what we call medullary thyroid cancer. And there's some other rare genetic things like MEN that are associated with that. And it really was in rodents where this was seen. And actually, the expression of these GLP-1 receptors in human C cells is lower than in rodents. And so this hasn't really been shown in humans, other than some nested case control studies recently. Yeah. And it even showed it for both types of thyroid cancer, maybe some association. But overall, those studies really don't, take into account the right factors, and there's a little bit of a screening bias or a monitoring or a, what do they call it? A detection bias, because, you know, they're looking for it. And so I'll tell you, you know, from an endocrinology perspective, we're the ones that end up seeing the relatively low risk types of thyroid cancer called papillary thyroid cancer. I'm certainly not worried about those. And that has nothing to do with the black box warning. So that shouldn't stop anybody. If you do have a history of medullary thyroid cancer, which is much more rare, or a family history of MEN2, you know, yeah, we're probably not going to give it until we know more safety data, because those are more severe, but they're very rare. And you should know about that. But otherwise, yeah, I'm not worried about it.
Rodents have the GLP-1 receptors on their C cells in their thyroid. Humans either do not, or it's very low expression, as my brother said. And, you know, they'll keep monitoring. I think when I get patients, they read those black box warnings. If they get any hoarseness at all, or even any, they'll start feeling their thyroid more, and they'll go and get screened more. And this means you're going to find more stuff. I don't think it's actually causing it, but I don't.
And so with that said, you know, if we started screening for thyroid cancer more, which is why we don't just do
We'd find it. We
start to find incidental low-risk thyroid cancers, and that's happened in other parts of the world, and nothing bad happens from those other than over-treatment. So just beware. Yeah. That's why we don't just start looking for stuff all the time.
Has to do with our podcast on over-testing and everything. Yeah.
Well, what about the pulse? So our friend, I hate to keep calling out Peter Attia, but he keeps scaremongering people about this stuff. He's the one that brought up the muscle loss with Ozempic, despite the clinical benefits. He's also recently talked about, it's increasing the pulse, the heart rate. And he went on this whole diatribe about how that's bad for the cardiovascular system.
Well, and he also said it wasn't really talked about in the literature.
And has been. We've known it since medical school.
In 2007, I started medical school. These drugs came out 2005, 2006, and Byetta, and very shortly after Victoza.
It was well known immediately.
That was like the most talked about thing. They didn't know if they improved cardiovascular risk, because they were worried about this increase in pulse. That was like the whole worry. So this is almost two decades.
So semaglutide,
very well established.
I mentioned the Ozempic cardiovascular outcome trial earlier. The pulse rate in this many, many thousands of people and for over several years went up by an average of 2 beats per minute, mind you. So that's barely anything. And more importantly, all the clinical benefits panned out, including overall cardiovascular risk reduction.
So in high-risk individuals, whether you have obesity or type 2 diabetes, I personally wouldn't worry about it. The benefit's going to outweigh the risk. Now, if you're one of these people using it for a small amount of weight loss and you're a relatively pretty healthy, athletic person, and you notice your resting heart rate and area under the curve heart rate, meaning throughout the day you can get an Apple Watch or whatever that's kind of monitoring your heart rate, and you see, and we see about 5 to 10 beats per minute over like the course of the day on average. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, we don't know. These drugs haven't been studied in this population. So is that risk not worth the small little benefit of a little bit of weight loss? Hard to know in this population. But if you have type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular risk, I would absolutely bet the farm, and we have the data to show the benefit. It's okay. So I wouldn't worry about that if the drug is actually indicated for you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, also for people are like, why is this happening? Well, they thought maybe it had to do with the autonomic nervous system and things like that. There are actually like these GLP-1 receptors on the SA node of the heart, which helps basically start the electricity beats in your heart. So that's what people think it is. Likely the case here. So anyway, kind of interesting.
Yeah. Without harm.
I wouldn't really worry about it. Those are kind of the big ones. Yeah. Pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, Ozempic face, lean mass. We already talked about lean mass loss 2 weeks ago. We don't need to harp
on
that.
Lift weights, please. Still.
Lift weights. Only take the drug if it's truly indicated. Not for vanity weight loss. These drugs aren't meant for short-term weight loss. Not everybody may need to be on them long-term, but most people likely will if they're on the medicine. I think that kind of covers it.
Yeah.
Make sure you give us a little share and a review on our Apple or whatever the heck you're listening to this. And if you notice any influencer or friends or anybody talking about this, send them this podcast. This should clear up most everything that they need to know.
Or maybe we'll get them on the podcast and grill them.
Yeah, we'll just start grilling people. Well, that might be good. Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.